Okay, so this is the last talk. And yes, of course, we've been exploring the bodhicitta on this retreat, the arising of the bodhicitta, looking at ways in which we can open up to that mysterious, suprapersonal, spiritual force. And we've looked at ways in which we might do that through individual spiritual practice. We looked especially at metta as a path, as well as yesterday we had a little look at intensive engagement with one another within the spiritual community. And in this last talk, I want to look at the third way of opening up to that bodhicitta, and that is through working with others to communicate the Dharma as widely as possible. Another way you could describe this is in terms of serving the Dharma through being involved with disseminating the Dharma, being involved in that work. But when we talk like this, we mean a lot more than, you know, giving a few talks and leading some classes. That's only a part of it. The project, to use that word, the Bodhisattva project, the Bodhisattva's work is much greater than that, much broader and deeper than that, much more radical than that. It is, in fact, nothing less than the project of building the Buddha land, building the Buddha land, or building the Buddha field, building a world in which everything is conducive to spiritual development, to Dharma development. It might seem fanciful speaking like this when we look around at what the world is like, and when we consider how, you know, little there is in the way of Buddhism and things, you know, perhaps a little like Buddhism. But the Bodhisattva tradition is very clear. Bodhisattvas purify the Buddha field. That's what they do. Bodhisattvas purify the Buddha field. That's the traditional phrase. This, of course, is something that Bhante's explored in that lecture series on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. A very important lecture series. And the first of that series is called Building the Buddha Land, or Building the Buddha Field. And he's also spoken, well, long before this, in terms of creating a new society, or even that the Triratna is a blueprint for a new world. People are not so keen on this language of new society. It seems a bit outmoded, but the vision is clear. There's another early lecture series on the Sutra of Golden Light, the transformation of self and world in the Sutra of Golden Light. And Bhante doesn't just talk about the individual aspect of transformation inspired by that sutra, but talks about the transformation of cultural life, economic life, even to an extent affecting political life, looking at the whole relationship between Buddhism and nature, and that kind of thing. It's very, very important material that needs revisiting. And, you know, he's laying down principles which, you know, will constantly need new application and will need revitalising. And we've got to do that work. Years and years ago, Sangharakshita said on a seminar, he said, "Look, I've started lots of hares running. It's for you to follow them up, to follow them and see where they take you." And but this whole business of spiritual life, Dharma life, Bodhisattva life is not just about transformation of self, it's transformation of world. It's essential to Sangharakshita's vision. It's essential to the vision of the Triratna Order. Whatever language you use, you prefer, that is the vision. It's not enough to have individual Buddhist practice. That will take us only so far. We also need to create environments which support our Buddhist practice and which support other people's Buddhist practice, which means working together with others to create and recreate and maintain such environments. In another lecture on the pillars of the Triratna, or the FWBO as it was then, one of the pillars, he says, is institutions. Again, not a happy word, really. We don't like that word. But by institutions, he means environments. Ways in which human beings organise themselves, come together to support the growth and the development of the individual. yes, creating environments which are very different from what is generally on offer. You know, we know that the Buddha and Buddhist tradition emphasizes the centrality of the mind. We hear about that a lot. If you want real lasting change, you need in the end to change your mind, to change your consciousness. And only we can do that. Only the individual can do that. In the end, only individual transformation of consciousness can lead to enlightenment. We're clear about that, of course. But, and it's a very important but, we mustn't fall into thinking that environment is unimportant. It doesn't mean that. Our environment, our world, our society does affect us. It does really impinge on consciousness. Of course it does, and it can really affect us very adversely indeed. You know, the environment, if it's not supportive of, you know, individual growth and transformation, it does the opposite. It holds you down. I'm just so vividly aware of this living in India, among Buddhists in India, seeing how poverty, caste discrimination, still, even though untouchability is outlawed by the Indian government, it still goes on as an attitude. There's the sheer toil of the daily grind, seeing people in, you know, really sort of hard jobs, having to travel a really long way on crowded Bombay commuter trains, and, you know, living in, you know, really difficult circumstances. It has a bad effect on people's consciousness. You know, you'll see people on Indian trains at the height of the rush hour standing up asleep. You know, sort of, they've learned how to hold on to a bar in a, you know, above them in a huddle, and they've sort of managed to work out how to sleep standing up. It's quite, it's like, well, that can't be very good for your consciousness, can it? I mean, it is amazing with our, you know, with Buddhist friends in India, our older members and mitras and friends in India, how much they actually push that back. They push back that, you know, very, very hard and difficult and adverse effect on their consciousness, how they rise above it and create, you know, through working together, through spiritual community, how they create environment and institutions and contexts which support liberation for one another. I'm reminded here of Dr. Ambedkar's early slogan, a great early slogan, which those of you with left-leaning, it might sound familiar, but Dr. Ambedkar used it in his own way. Educate, agitate, organise. First of all, educate, show the people, teach the people about blind faith, about superstition, about caste. You know, educate them out of that. Give them the means to educate themselves out of that. Raise consciousness. Show them that an individual can develop. You know, break down through knowledge, through you know, communication. Break down the ways in which they've been imprisoned by the external society and by themselves, and then agitate, get them to agitate, to make changes within themselves, make changes between each other, agitate as well for a different world, and organise. Agitation isn't enough. Organise, create new social structures characterised, yes, by liberty, equality, fraternity. This is what Dr. Ambedkar said. And he said, liberty and equality and fraternity are not, in fact, learnt from the French Revolution. Dr. Ambedkar said he learnt liberty, equality and fraternity from his teacher, the Buddha. So there you are. And Dr. Ambedkar's, by the way, vision of liberty, equality and fraternity is basically metta. It's basically metta, if you actually look into it. The practice of metta, the life of metta, but also metta as part of the, if you like, social contract, part of the way society organises itself, if you like, the organisation of life around metta. Very interesting and important insights from Dr. Ambedkar there. So we need to be careful not to turn the Dharma into something purely mental, one-sidedly mental, and carry on in a good, comfortable, yes, even bourgeois sort of fashion, but without really affecting the environment and the structures around us without creating new environments and structures. Obviously, we're part of society, we're part of society's wider institutions, and of course, we benefit them from them enormously. I'm not saying that, you know, all the ways in which we organise ourselves or we're organised, if you like, within our societies are all bad. Not at all. You know, I'm deeply appreciative of many aspects of, you know, the way in which British society is arranged and organised. But within that, we can create environments in which people can breathe a different air, so to speak, an air that supports their individual spiritual transformation, an air that supports the creation of a loving, harmonious, creative, active spiritual community. We all of us benefit greatly from the efforts of many in the very early days of our movement, of our Sri Ratna movement, you know, the London Buddhist Centre, and all the different things, the communities and livelihoods around there. Well, people gave so much in the early days to make that possible, to turn that, you know, really beaten up ruin of an old fire station, to turn that into a really fabulous Buddhist centre, which has also had a big impact on the surrounding environment. It sort of changed almost the demographic of that part of London. Windhorse Trading, you know, a lot of people worked really, really hard to get that company off the ground, and so many people benefit now from the efforts of people early on. And same with Padmaloka, so many people have put so much energy and effort so that we can benefit. So, and it's the same with different centres all over the place. So we mustn't just rest on their efforts, the fruit of their efforts, and go passive. There's much more to do. We've got to maintain and develop our existing environments, and we need to create new ones for more people. In the Bodhisattva tradition, we find another way of describing this. It's the sort of practical, concrete application of building the Buddha land. It's said that a Bodhisattva, as part of his ethics, part of his moral behaviour, it's said that he practices what's known as the Parigraha Guna Shila, the ethics of gathering or attracting a Guna, a community. So that it's the Bodhisattva behaviour of attracting, gathering a community. And it's said that he does this in a number of ways, and this reflects very much the traditional circumstances in which these texts emerged. He will gather together resources for them, because they're presumably talking about an experienced and respected monk. He will, because of his standing, gather for his community of people who are going to practice together, material things such as robes and bedding and food and lodgings for people to come together to practice. In other words, he creates the material conditions that people need to practice the Dharma. So we need to start applying this principle to our own circumstances. And in our own movement, Banti started this, you know, by encouraging us to build centres, to start communities, to start livelihoods, so that people could gather to live a Dharma life. And we need to continue that, tradition. It's extraordinarily important. We need to support these structures and environments. And I know, looking around, probably most of you cannot live in communities or work in team-based right livelihoods or even work full-time in a centre because you have other responsibilities. But even though that's the case, it's in your interest to support these places. It's really in your interest to encourage the formation of communities, as I'm talking to a group of men, encourage the formation of men's communities, and to encourage people to work together in livelihood if at all possible, and of course encourage people to work together as much as possible in a centre. It's in your interest because you will benefit from them. You will benefit from them, as well as those being of benefit to others. Something I noticed in Sheffield, which is a centre I'm probably the public centre I'm most familiar with at the moment, noticing the way the men's community operates above the centre, how there was over the years that the men's community have invited people in, you know, family people, people who don't live in communities, inviting them to stay over, organising things for them, supporting class teams to go and eat a meal with them before the class and so on. And strong connections and friendships, you know, have been made between people in the community and between married men or single men or whatever who are don't want to be or can't be in a community. And it's obvious that what's going on there, that the vision of that, of some of the men in the men's community, is that that place is a resource for the men's sangha generally. And it's had a very, very positive and energising effect, I think, generally on the men's scene in Sheffield. And I know this happens in other places as well. So it's really important, you know, if you're around a centre and you're getting involved, will encourage, you know, men's communities to develop. And if you're in a men's community already, definitely have an altruistic focus. Definitely think this community, as a community, can benefit people. If you can, if you've got the room and the space, well, let people dip into it so that they can enjoy it and appreciate it and benefit from it. So let's all of us then participate in the gathering of the Gunna. The gathering of the community. It needs to be gathered again and again and yet again. It's very important. And everybody needs to be involved with that activity of attracting people to the wider Buddhist community, so that people can not only learn the Dharma, not only practice the Dharma, but can be in an environment that really supports their Dharma practice, their transformation. At least for a little while, that they might be in, you know, a faint reflection of a Buddha field itself, a pure Buddha field, because, you know, typically the Buddha fields, you know, like Sakavati, like Abhirati, these archetypal Buddha fields are environments where all you have to do is sort of turn up, and the Dharma sort of happens to you. We haven't got it quite like that, you know, at least we've got something like that, a reflection of that. So we all need to be involved in that. So what I want to do for the rest of this talk is to look at ways in which we can work with others to take the Dharma out and to create these environments for others. It's really an important part of your training if you've asked for ordination. And it should be an important part of one's life as an order member, as a Dharmachari. And it's really something to be watchful of when you've asked for ordination. After people ask for ordination, because they have limited time very often, because they have other responsibilities, it can mean that they stop being involved in the activity of taking the Dharma out to others. You know, what can happen is somebody asks for ordination, so they stop going, for example, to the Sangha night or supporting the beginner's course, because they go to Mitra study, and they go to their Going for Refuge group, and that's it. So there's no involvement in the sort of outreach work, either at the centre or even in an outreach project. And I think that actually can have a negative effect. It can lead, I think, to that one-sided negative self-reference that Bhante spoke about in that section I read from Know Your Mind. So if you're limited with your time, maybe you need to think in terms of sort of blocks of time. Maybe it's something to talk about in your Going for Refuge group or Mitra study group, saying, well, why don't we do a period when we're together exploring the Dharma intensively together? And then let's have an eight-week period where we go and support a beginner's course as a Going for Refuge group, something like that, or as a Mitra study group. I know some people do this. Or let's go and give energy to the Sangha night, something like that. Or let's ask an order member if he can do an outreach project, and we'll, you know, in a community centre or in another place, and we'll go with them. And I've seen this happen, and with real success. For a start, it brings the group together very strongly, because if you have a common project of spreading the Dharma, I'm going to talk about this a bit later, it really brings you together very strongly. But more positively, you're actively involved in benefiting other people, which is so positive, so good for those other people, and of course good for you. You also learn much more how to communicate the Dharma, just by watching order members, watching the people who take the classes, watching what they do. You learn so much just from being around them and how they respond to things, how they put things out there. So taking the Dharma out is an important part of your training. And anyway, I'm going to explore this by looking at the traditional Mahayana teaching, which has roots in the Pali Canon itself. It seems to have been originally a teaching of the Buddha himself, called the Four Sangraha Vastus, which are often translated as the elements of conversion, but probably a better translation is means of unification. Bhante's explored these in that Vimalakirti Nidesha series. It can be glossed as a way in which a bodhisattva unifies a community to work for the creation of the Buddha field. I'm going to look at these four areas as ways we can take the Dharma out, what's involved with taking the Dharma out, working together with others to take the Dharma out. So the first of the Sangraha Vastus is dana, generosity, giving, an old favourite. Generosity unifies. It brings people together. In that lecture in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Bhante says a spiritual community should be characterised by the constant exchange of gifts, the constant exchange of presents even. Dana is the expression of our awareness of other people's needs, the expression also of our delighted awareness at others, so that we want them to be enriched. And taking the Dharma out to others involves much generosity. We give our time, we give our energy, we even can give our money for the furtherance of the Dharma, the spread of the Dharma. You know, if you're involved in a class team, a centre team, or involved in an outreach group, well, it involves a lot of time and energy. You know, setting up the class, putting out the chairs, the cushions, making the tea. If you're involved in an outreach group, you might lend your car, you know, to drive cushions to the place, shrine stuff to the place. Yes, making tea and making more tea and so on, or coffee if you're from a culture that doesn't do so much tea. Now, these things might seem like small things, you know, when you look at the sort of cosmic activities of bodhisattvas, but all of these small things add up to creating a really good atmosphere. A really good atmosphere. And they're hugely significant. And when this generosity is alive in a class team, well, in a way, it's ordinary and very human when this generosity is alive. I mean, it really is something so basic, but it creates generosity among those coming along. It's, you know, generosity sort of begets generosity. When people see it and they realise, oh, hey, this is not some slick professional evening institute or something like that. This is a group of friends working together because they love this thing called Buddhism, called the Dharma or meditation or whatever it is. They want to be part of that. They want to contribute to that. I was at a small outreach group in Chesterfield recently, in a really unusual and interesting little place. It's something that a couple of order members have started who live in Chesterfield. This is a town near Sheffield. And I had a free evening, so I went along. And I was really struck within the group, which was, you know, more or less a beginner's group with people edging into going beyond beginner's level. But all of the people who came brought food. You know, there's one woman there, who came along. She just loves baking. So she just brought these fabulous cakes. Really good thing as far as I'm concerned. But what was lovely was this wonderful sort of atmosphere of sharing. Even though these were, you know, there was about 10 or 12 people there, most of them fairly new, but there was this very quickly, this very strong atmosphere of the shared project. Yes, of course, the, you know, order members were doing the communicating of the Dharma, but it was obvious going there that it was everybody's thing. And it was fantastic. I really rejoiced in that. And there really was such a good atmosphere. It was obvious that people regarded it as their group in a really positive way. And when that atmosphere is present, it's very, very easy to give the Dharma. It's very easy to explore the Dharma with one another. It emerges so easily. If the atmosphere is cool, frosty, standoffish, it's really hard work to communicate the Dharma. The Dharma does need an atmosphere of that warmth and generosity. So we need to create that, you know, in our teams and running classes between each other and to those coming in, so that the Dharma can really be vividly present. And this kind of giving and generosity also, it's also connected with creativity, actually. When we're involved in communicating the Dharma, especially perhaps in new places, but also in centres, especially if the, you know, the centre is going a bit flat, you need to bring ingenuity into what's going on. Ingenuity and imagination. I would say that's all part of generosity. If you have that spirit of generosity, you become ingenious about how to communicate. You know, this, you know, like these people in Chesterfield who found this, you know, medieval, you know, disused chapel that had been turned into a community centre. It's a great place to meditate. It's one of, you know, immediately it's got a strong atmosphere, for example. Or turning a not very good place into something special. I've certainly seen that. A place which is really sort of institutional and really not very pleasant. But with a bit of imagination, a bit of generosity, you turn it into something different. You do turn it into a place for really good, really good Dharma exploration. I mean, in India, when in the early days, when we didn't have a centre, we had to communicate the Dharma in the most amazing places, very strange places. I remember one was somebody's garage where they kept their car. But the car was out on Sunday mornings because it was a Christian family. So my order member friends, Indian friends, they kind of persuaded these Christians to let us use the garage. And I gather that they're obviously Protestants, not Catholics, because they said, "Well, are you going to encourage, you know, the use of birth control among Dalit people?" And they said, "Oh yes, of course we'll do that." You know, they only told me this later, we didn't do that at all. A bit of a fib, skillful means. But we used to have this garage, you know, with a corrugated iron roof and all the rest of it, and oil on the floor. But we turned it into a fantastic place, and people were sort of spilling outside, and, you know, we had some really good Dharma times there. I mean, it does help that it's usually sunny. You know, or we persuaded the chowkidar, the watchman of a house which had a big veranda. We managed to persuade him to let us use this veranda for a class on Sunday morning. So, you know, we'd all pile into this place in the middle of Pune, and about 100 people would sit on this veranda. We were basically squatting, you know, to explore the Dharma. Or I remember a class where I had to go where it was a community centre, but the community centre was an old wooden railway wagon that had just been, you know, dumped on this piece of wasteland with mud floor. I had no electricity, so I would be doing Dharma, you know, teaching the Dharma, communicating about meditation. And I couldn't even see everybody in the room because Indian candles are so feeble. You know, I didn't even know who was there, but we had some really good meditations there. You know, teaching the Dharma in slums in India is fantastic, because people usually do it up with fairy lights and all that sort of thing. But I'm sure you've all got your own stories about going somewhere and making it a special place. Well, this is all part of generosity. It's all part of that. And of course, centres and the classes at centres need to be constantly renewed and refreshed. That's part of generosity. You know, if you feel that your things aren't sort of, haven't got the energy that you know, they need a bit more energy or more creativity in your centre, well, go and tell the order members you think that. If you've got ideas of how you can improve the general atmosphere and the general environment, well, you know, tell them, or ways in which more and different people could be connected to the centre. Go and tell them. I don't mean tell them rudely, so you're not doing it properly, you know, stupid order members and all the rest of it. Don't do it like that. You won't get a good response. But suggest. Have input. Don't go passive with this stuff. You know, we need to constantly renew and refresh what we're doing. It's said in this, some of the texts describing a bodhisattva's ethics, a bodhisattva is painstakingly resourceful in the way he communicates the Dharma. He goes out of his way to connect with people, to befriend people, to connect with them, trying all sorts of different ways to reach them. In the end, the generosity is the giving of oneself. Fully and completely, you know, giving one's life really to the communication of the Dharma. Bhante is so fond of quoting that Walt Whitman line from Leaves of Grass: "Behold, I do not give lectures or a little charity. When I give myself." So, you know, we're not involved in giving lectures and a little charity. We're giving ourselves when we give the Dharma. You know, we're giving ourselves fully. It's our life. We give our life to others. And this can be very challenging, of course, sometimes. I know what it's like. I still feel it myself. There you are at a class or, you know, a centre or an outreach group, whatever, and you feel shy. You feel shy. You feel a bit nervous because there's all these new people and, you know, everybody's a little bit, they're shy too sometimes. So because they're shy, you feel shy. And, you know, you're sort of a little bit standoffish. You know, I still feel that even after all these years. You know, there's also that feeling of, my goodness, I might be the first Buddhist that they ever meet. You know, don't want to give you too much pressure, but you might be the first Buddhist that person ever meets. You could make a real difference to their lives, or to whether they connect with the Dharma or not. Well, I think it's quite important to feel that, actually. When they find out that you're a Mitra, that you're training for ordination, they obviously, the stakes go up. They'll view you in a different way. You'll have much more of an effect than you realise. Well, get used to it, because one day you'll have a kesa, you'll have an order name, and people will be expecting you to, be a bit special, be a bit different. And yes, you've got to be yourself, but yes, you do stand for something if you wear a kesa and you have a Buddhist name. Sometimes order members avoid the kesa. I think it's a cop-out. I really do. I mean, I know people say, well, it's a barrier, you know, between communication. Well, get used to it. It's not a barrier. I've always worn kesa at classes. It's never been a barrier. You only make it a barrier if you're not really connected with going for refuge. And you can break down very, very easily any kind of sense of self-consciousness. So, yes, when we're involved in communicating the Dharma, we need to be more aware of the effects that we have on others. And this is a very, very good practice. In fact, the Bodhisattva ethics that I mentioned, you could say a lot of them, some of them I didn't mention, but a lot of them are about the ethics that come in when you have responsibility in relation to others, where you're the more experienced person the stakes go up. In a way, you don't have a private life anymore. You really don't. You are, as it were, on show. You do stand for something. And that's a really good thing, because it impacts on your own practice. Doesn't mean that you pretend. Doesn't mean you're not honest about, you know, your own faults and failings. But you have a responsibility. So that's a bit on generosity. Secondly, there's loving speech. Priya vadita. Priya vadita. Affectionate speech. Priya is a really lovely word. Very strong words. Affection, love. It means that the people are very dear to you. So this is speech that is uttered from full awareness of others. When we communicate the Dharma, we are as aware as we possibly can be of others. And of course, that means, first of all, being courteous, being hospitable. This is very important when we're first making contact with people, and we need to keep it going, you know, even when we're getting more familiar with people, really being courteous and hospitable. And putting people at their ease, really helping, you taking the responsibility, as it were, for breaking the ice. It's a really big thing for them coming along to that class very often. Perhaps recall what it was like when you first came along and how you felt. We'll keep that in mind, because people were probably like that as well. And if you walked in with great swagger and confidence, well, not everybody's like that, actually. So keep that in mind. We might even have to sort of bear other people's discomfort at first. I remember there was a very, very shy man that used to come to the Croydon Centre when I was there. And he'd come every week to the class. And he'd always stand in the corner, away from people, and, you know, one of those people that would sort of hide in the bookshop or behind, you know, a cup of tea if they could find the biggest mug. And I always made a point of going and talking to them and asking them how they were and how their life was, how their family was, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And it was excruciating. I found it really painful, because he was shy. I felt really uncomfortable. And I could only talk to him for a short period. And I think he, you know, found it enough, you know, the amount of time we spent together. Eventually, he became an order member. In fact, I ordained him. We formed a very strong connection. And he said, when he told a life story, that how grateful he was that I went out to him. He said it made such a difference, just somebody coming to him every week and asking him how he was. It was very simple things. We weren't having profound conversations. I just showed interest, even though I found it all uncomfortable, even though he found it uncomfortable. I showed interest, and it contributed to him connecting with the Dharma. And also, looking back, interesting to think of this. I can think of people who came to the centre in those days in Croydon who, you know, were really bright, fantastic, fun to be with, really up for the Dharma. They disappeared. So, you know, the really sort of lively, fantastic people don't necessarily turn into the committed people. Kindly speech means befriending, and, in time, it's important to show real interest in people, all right, from the beginning. But, you know, obviously without frightening people and freaking them out, you know, when you think it's the right time, well, suggest you meet up in other contexts. Meet up for tea, invite them to your community or your home when it's the right time, or meet them in a cafe or something like that, or suggest ways they can engage more deeply in the centre or the group, if they show interest. Obviously, this must be without expectation on our part. I can recall many disappointments over the years where I showed, a lot of interest in somebody and it seemed to be reciprocated, and yes, they disappeared. But that just showed that how, if you like, conditioned what I thought was my metta actually was, and that's a very good training as well. Then there's loving speech and friendships within the team itself, running the class or the group. This is incredibly important. Over the years, I've formed some very close, warm and loving friendships with order members, mitras and friends, because we've been working together to share the Dharma with others. I experienced that very strongly here at Padmaloka, living and working with the ordination team and others in the community. Just some very, very strong bonds formed, that really go a long way. It's to do with our common desire, not just to practice the Dharma, but to give the Dharma and be involved in giving the Dharma to others. I remember when I lived in Bombay in India, where we did a lot of Dharma work, me and the order members and mitras, almost every night of the week. We were going somewhere to take a class, to give a Dharma talk, or we'd be doing day retreats at the weekends. It really was a lot of work, and most all of them, apart from me, they all had day jobs. I just had night jobs, more than a night. You can't call it a job teaching the Dharma, but they were working in the day as well. But it was a really happy group. There's a lot of harmony between us and a lot of fun, a lot of pleasure and a lot of adventures, going to these far off places in Greater Bombay to, do something with the Dharma, and a lot of spontaneity, a lot of sort of Dharma emerging on the spot between us. I mean, my manager, a little order member named Vimala Ketu, who knew very little English, but and he was quite a rough fellow. He was a greaser on the Bombay buses. He used to grease the axles. That was his day job. And at night, he was a Dharma revolutionary. And, we go to these areas, and I'd turn up, and I'd been thinking about a talk, maybe even written up a whole talk. And it was obvious. It was totally out of connection with what I found in this slum area. And Vimala Ketu would always lean over to me and he'd say, "Strong talk." And I'd say, "What talk?" He said, and that meant you've got to give a talk on the perils of drink because there's a lot of alcoholism in this slum. So I had to give, really strong talks on why it's not a good idea to eat, to drink, the really hard gut rot that these people were drinking, which meant that I had to understand why people drank, the sort of depression of people's lives and things like that, and propose a way, an alternative way. And I have to say, it did work. You did get people giving up drink and taking up meditation. I invented a new kind of drink called Amrit brand, Amrit nectar brand, Daru, that's liquor, which you can get for free every Saturday night down at the meditation centre, down at the meditation class, and it doesn't give you any bad side effects as well. So, a lot of spontaneity. Or we'd go to a place where it was a Buddhist area, but they were all kind of wealthy Buddhists who had good government jobs, and he'd say, "Strong talk, Dalit Brahmins," which meant Dalit is the word for downtrodden, Brahmin is, of course, the higher caste, but he's basically saying these people have got lots of money, but they're not doing anything for the Dharma, for their people. So you've got to give a strong talk about total Dharma revolution. So I learnt a lot, doing all that. And we did make a strong impression on people. People were very attracted by how close we were to one another. And that's as important, if not more important. I realised one day, the fact that we were all together, I'd give a talk, my interpreter would translate, somebody else would lead the refuges and precepts, because they're all Buddhists, somebody would do the introduction, somebody would do the thank you at the end. And they saw the way we enjoyed each other, and I realised one day, this is more important than me doing the Dharma talk. My Dharma talk is, by this foreigner, is a way to pull the people in, and it does give them some good ideas. But the real meaning of what we're doing is them seeing this harmonious, loving community, people loving being together. You know, and for a while, when you're doing something like that, you do start to feel that you yourself are transcending self and other with your brothers and sisters in the Dharma, and people are getting a vision of the Sangha. That's what you're doing. There's a saying in the Pali Canon, Samana Dasanam. It's one of the mangalas, the auspicious signs, the vision of the Samanas, the vision of the wanderers. The Buddha says it's really auspicious to see those who are committed to the spiritual life. Well, our equivalent of that is people seeing, I think, harmonious Sangha. If they get a vision of that, they think, what are these people on? They're all themselves. It's not pretense. They haven't just got those sort of simpering sort of spirit, pseudo-spiritual smiles. They're obviously, you know, real people, down-to-earth people, but they're on something that makes them enjoy each other. People want to have a bit of that. And, you know, I think very often as well, if we work together a lot more to communicate the Dharma, if that was really central, if we'd really clot the bodhicitta, well, people wouldn't have the kind of problems that they have between each other. You know, some of the disharmonies that can happen in the Sangha, and it does in the order, sometimes quite serious ones. Very often, I think people are thinking too much about themselves, and they're not thinking of the effect on other people. They're not thinking of the spread of the Dharma. Quite an interesting point. You know, is every disharmony in the Sangha because the people involved are not thinking deeply enough about the spread of the Dharma and the bodhicitta? Discuss. Okay, number three, artacharya. Artacharya, which means literally something like living meaningfully. Arta is meaning, but it can also mean the good and the goal. So it's living meaningfully, or living for the good, or living for the goal. Arta, the Buddha can use arta to mean the goal of the spiritual life, enlightenment itself, the deep meaning and purpose of life. And in the Bodhisattva tradition, this is identified with communicating the Dharma. Living meaningfully, living for the good and the goal, is communicating the Dharma. So I think that's really instructive. A life devoted to the goal, to the good, is identified with communicating the Dharma. The Buddha himself, of course, says that giving the Dharma is the greatest of all possible gifts, which is an incredible thing to say, given that he also mentions the gift of money. That's a big thing to give. Some people find that, you know, quite difficult, the giving of material things generally. Giving the Dharma is greater than that. It's greater even than the gift of fearlessness, giving people confidence. It's greater even than the gift of life and limb. I mean, I find it impossible to imagine how somebody might give quite consciously, without impulse, but quite consciously, the best thing to do is to actually give their life for others. Well, that's, you know, that is an extraordinary thought. Giving the Dharma is even greater than that. It's greater than that because the Dharma is the gift of life. Because Dharma is the very essence of life. That's what this is really saying. And we need to perhaps reflect on how much we really value the Dharma and what we understand the Dharma to be for it to be the greatest gift. I mean, there are friends of mine, very good friends of mine, who've made it very clear that if they had not encountered the Dharma, if they'd not met Sangharakshita, they would be dead, or they would be insane, and they mean it. I mean, you know, one case I know that he would have just destroyed himself if he hadn't encountered the Dharma. It's not being over dramatic. Sangharakshita was once asked, "What would you have done if you hadn't been a Buddhist?" He said, "I would have gone mad." Which really shocked people. We didn't say, oh, I would have been a writer, or I would have been a this, or I would have gone mad, he said, because the forces and contradictions in his being would have just destroyed him, which is, you know, well worth reflecting on. The Dharma is what life is really all about. If people don't have the Dharma, in a sense, they're not really living. And when I say the Dharma, I don't mean sectarian Buddhism. I don't mean Tri Ratna as a sect or a jargon. I'm talking about what life is for. You know, we're here living. We have this amazing thing called consciousness, this reflective self-awareness. You know, we have the ability as human beings to reflect, to imagine. We're not just locked in sense experience. We can sort of stand back from it and do something with it. We can imagine, transcending even that reflexive awareness, moving into an even greater awareness. So human beings, because of that, have this amazing potential for nobility of being, for want of a better way of putting it, for wisdom and love and all the distinctively human qualities, and for the expression and creation of great beauty. We have that potentiality. But people really get the chance to develop all of that. Conditioning squeezes us. Conditioning conspires against that. It traps us, traps people, narrows down options, and can lead to sort of depression, meaninglessness, even violence and criminality and self-destruction, or just a sort of boredom and habitual sort of life. You know, and I think that the destructive stuff is very often because it's very positive energy that's blocked and trapped. You sort of notice this among Buddhist people in India, you know, with backgrounds with very, very little sort of prospects. Well, they end up becoming violent. You know, some of our older members have had very violent pasts. You know, and they said, well, then they encountered the Dharma and it changed. It just changed because there was energy sort of blocked and dammed up. Well, that's not just true of India. That's true of people everywhere. I just sort of struck by, you know, how nowadays the range of options for people is just so incredible. But even then, even though people have a lot available to them, if they don't get something like the Dharma, they don't really develop themselves. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, Tri Ratna is the answer for everybody and all the rest of it. I'm not being sectarian. But the thing is, people need to grow and flourish in this life if they're going to be happy and satisfied. And we can be part of giving people the means for that. Vimalakirti says that a bodhisattva's love has the particular quality of ripening and maturing others. The word is paripachana, ripening and maturing others. That's the particular quality of a bodhisattva's love. So that's the sort of attitude that we need to have. Bring that into your metta bhavana. Bring that into your engagement with other people. What can I do to enable people to really ripen and mature so that they can really sort of develop that wonderful quality of consciousness that is human consciousness? So giving the Dharma is to others means, to give them the means to mature and flourish and ripen, to grow and expand beyond what life has dealt them. And in the end, the Dharma offers the means of transcendence of self and other, liberation, and the natural, spontaneous creativity of those on the transcendental path, the stream entrance and bodhisattvas. So when we give the Dharma, we're giving people this skillfully, you know, with awareness of where they are, maybe gently at first, a gentle introduction, but at the same time, don't sell people short. Some people, as I said yesterday, want the Dharma in its fullness early on. You know, they want to know that there's an adventure that's possible. You know, that was very much what I wanted, and I don't think I'm unusual. Giving the Dharma means you have to, of course, know the Dharma. So if you're involved in spreading the Dharma in any way, if you want to be involved in that, You need to study the Dharma. You need to reflect on the Dharma. You need to have a regular meditation practice. You need to work on yourself. You need to turn the Dharma that you're studying into experience. And you also need to learn how to communicate the Dharma. In the early days, Bhante used to say, all order members need to have available 3 talks. They need to have prepared 3 talks so that if they're asked to give a talk somewhere, they can do it immediately. There should be a talk on the Buddha and Buddhism, a talk on Buddhist meditation, and a talk on a Dharma topic of their own choice. I think that was the 3. So start preparing those talks. Get ready. Not necessarily on this retreat, but get ready, because who knows, you might be asked. Somebody, you know, there might be a flu epidemic. All the order members have gone down. The class has got to go ahead. Who's going to lead it? Somebody's going to say, you are, Graham. You're going to lead it. Sorry, Graham, I just saw. Oh, we've done this before, haven't we? We've done this before. And you've done it, haven't you? Yeah, so there you are. Another thing that we used to have, and I think it'd be good if we brought them in again, is speakers' classes. I think many of us, go back to your centres and ask your study group leaders or the order members, you know, can you arrange speakers' classes so I can learn how to communicate the Dharma? Pappavedra says it's very important. Probably get lots of rude emails. But, you know, Bhante used to have speakers' classes for order members in the early days, and he used to be at the class and give feedback to people about how they'd got on with their talk. Yes. And of course, sometimes people also wonder, this often comes up, and I think it's a good sign when it comes up. People think, you know, who am I to be communicating the Dharma? Well, it's a very, you know, simple answer to that. Well, if you're not going to do it, who is? You know, probably we're not the best people. We're definitely not the best people to be taking classes, you know, in our town or in our centre or whatever. But who else is doing it? And if we don't do it, who will do it? Just turn those things away. You know, the fact is, you have it. There is this situation. These people have needs. So communicate the Dharma. So this brings up the 4th of the Sangraha Vastus, exemplification, samanartata, practicing what you preach, as we have it in the English language, equalizing what you teach, what you communicate, and what you are. And this is very difficult because much of the Dharma is beyond us. Sometimes people even say, well, no, you shouldn't talk about anything if you haven't experienced it directly. Well, what are you going to say to people then? That really isn't the point. We should still show the Dharma in its fullness, still open it to people, but be very clear that this is the Dharma. It's not us. It's the Dharma. Bhante said to me some years ago, I was talking about my limitations, and in his reassurance to me that I should carry on communicating the Dharma, he said, look, see yourself as an agent, a medium for the Dharma. He says, that's the way I see myself. What's important is that people get the Dharma. We have this lovely word in the Pali tradition for the communication of the Dharma, somebody who's involved in that, a Dharma Duta. Dhamma Duta, a messenger of the Dharma. So don't think of yourself as a teacher of the Dharma, but as a messenger of the Dharma, connecting people with the Dharma. The Buddha says in a little sutta where he's talking about communicating the Dharma, he says it's a wrong view to think. You're not a good Dharma teacher if you think before a talk that you're about to give, may they have faith in me. But you would be a good Dharma teacher if you thought, through this may they have faith in the Dharma. Then you're on the right track. So you share what you're inspired by, what you know, appropriately, tuned into the needs of the people you're talking to. You share your efforts, you also share your struggles, You share your successes. You might even share your failures. What you exemplify most of all is your going for refuge, is your effort, is your faith, your friendliness, your devotion. Not by talking about yourself all the time. Your experience is just sort of there, perfuming and pervading your involvement with the class, you know, with the group. You don't have to be saying, well, I've experienced this and I've experienced that. You don't need to do that. It's just sort of there, only if it illustrates the point well. Samanatata can also be translated as sympathy. And some of the interpretations of the Sangravasis explain this in terms of sympathy, empathy with others. Others treating others as the same as you. I mentioned that word, anukampa, trembling with, shaking with, resonating with others. So the class team needs to be really tuned up to those coming along, and individually and collectively, really attuned to the atmosphere in the class and what's going on with the individuals in it. And we need to be deeply sympathetic to the efforts and struggles and successes of others. You know, and not be, you know, sometimes people come along in all sorts of weird and wonderful states. Well, have to be a bit careful not to, you know, sort of make jokes about that. It's very easily done, you know, perhaps to let off steam. I mean, Arloka told me a story that Bhante called the then Norwich Council to Padmaloka for a meeting. And because Bhante used to go through the centre minutes, and he said, I was looking through your minutes, and I've noticed that you've said there are a lot of nutters coming along to the beginners class. Nutters meaning mad people, if you don't, you know, but it's a bit, you know. You know, it's not, if somebody's called a nutter, if they knew they were being called that, it wouldn't go down very well. And Bhante said, I could tell you how you seemed to me when you first came along. And it was obvious what the point was. You know, look, come on. You know, you need to connect with people and not sort of dismiss them. You know, at the same time, you know, we do, sometimes people can be very disturbed and we have to, you know, we might not be able to help them. There's another ethic here of the Bodhisattva, the Cittanuvartana Shila, the ethics of attuning the mind, the heart to others. Really tuning into people's concerns, interests, their potential, their qualities, and you connect that with the Dharma. I mean, Bhante really does seem to have this. He has this amazing ability to tune into people and to connect it with almost any aspect of the Dharma. I've often told the story of being in India with him, where to a few thousand Buddhists, Dalit people, quite a few at that time would have been illiterate as well. This is back in the 70s. And he starts off the talk with an exposition of Yogacara consciousness. And I thought, blimey, you know, that's a bit bold, you know, going into this very sophisticated Vijnana system, you know, going right through it. I thought, where is he going? Where are we ending up? And then he got to what's known as the Klishto Mano Vijnana, the defiled mind consciousness, the consciousness that distinguishes between self and other, that believes in a subject-object dichotomy. And then he said, and this is where caste comes from. This is where untouchability comes from this dualistic consciousness. And that, you know, in Indian talks, if people make a good point, there's applause. So there was this fantastic applause. He'd done this thing and then related it right to their actual situation. Extraordinary. But we can all do this in our own way. Sangha is a wonderful practice for this. This is where teams are so important. You know, you talk about the people coming along and what's happening to them and how they can be helped. You might even sort of think, well, actually, I think it would be good if they connected up with an order member not here or something like that, who's really interested in this particular area or who has experience. It's a beautiful thing about the Sangha. You can connect people all over the place. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's such a rich community that people can connect with. You know, and in that sense, you can feel it's a bit, as a collective, we're like a bodhisattva. But it comes out of this real tuning in to other people. Gosh, this is a bit long, isn't it? This is what you don't do in a talk. Give a great big long talk where people are really flagging with too much information. So anyway, quickly going on. So I think you can see from all this how much we can change and grow through being intensively involved in working to spread the Dharma with others. And most important of all, others really benefiting and growing and flourishing and coming together more deeply through our communication of the Dharma. And sometimes a real magic happens. It's the only word for it. The conditions come together. You know, there's all the sort of work of communicating the Dharma, of, you know, being in this loving connection with one another. And sometimes, and you don't even know why or how it's happening, that a special quality seems to come in, a kind of magic, a touch of the inconceivable, as Bhante calls it, as if suddenly people are not separated, as if there is a kind of quality of consciousness, to use that word, and it is just a word, a quality present that somehow is both individual and yet there is the deepest harmony, and there's an effortlessness to it, and there's a flow to it, and it's incredibly pleasurable and deeply satisfying for everybody involved. And perhaps for a moment, just for a moment, we're all of us present are liberated from that prison of self-reference, that prison of self and other. For a moment, everybody in the class, everybody in the centre, everybody in the little outreach group are just touched by something else. Perhaps it's that suprapersonal force. Perhaps it's the bodhicitta. Perhaps it's Avalokiteshvara. Who knows? But these are moments, these are glimpses of a world transformed, moments of true spiritual community. If you like, the real order. Perhaps these are times when we really are in a Buddha field together.